Thought Leadership Studio.
You're listening to Thought Leadership Studio, the podcast that helps you master high-level positive mass influence to create distinctive business niches, captivate an audience, grow your following, and change the game by changing the frame with strategic thought leadership.
Thought Leadership Studio.
Welcome back to Thought Leadership Studio. I'm your host, Chris McNeil, and this is episode 96, Leading with Integrity and Imagination with Jonathan Bennett. Leading through change, ethical insight for the thoughtful professional. What this episode will do for you is meet a purpose-driven leadership guide by getting introduced to Jonathan Bennett, executive coach, strategic advisor, and founder of Laerday, a B Corp certified consulting firm dedicated to meaningful, values-aligned change. Clarify the roles of coach, consultant, and advisor by understanding the distinctions and overlap between those roles and why meeting clients where they are matters more than labels. To learn from real-world complexity by hearing how Jonathan's experiences in high-pressure healthcare environments shaped his approach to leadership, organizational development, and ethical decision-making. To explore values in action, discovering how Jonathan connects organizational values to actual behaviors, ensuring that stated principles aren't just slogans on a wall, but part of the culture's DNA, and help you navigate career crossroads with clarity, gaining tools and insights for recognizing when it's time to make a change and how to turn uncertainty into a structured path for growth and transformation. But before we dive further in, let's take a quick step back. If you're new here, welcome to Thought Leadership Studio. I'm Chris McNeil, strategic thought leadership coach, consultant, and trainer. Developer of the thought process of strategic thought leadership and author of the upcoming book, Strategic Thought Leadership. That's a lot of strategic thought leaderships. But I created this podcast to empower forward-thinking leaders like you to break free from conventional, outdated marketing traps that treat people as data points rather than the engaged learners they are. Strategic thought leadership shifts the game by focusing on guiding your audience to new ways of thinking that help them extract more value out of your product or service category, make smarter buying decisions, or maybe even attach new higher values to your category while leading them to also revere your or your organization's special, unique benefits or ways of doing things. It's not about pushing content. It's about empowerment, reshaping beliefs, expanding worldviews, and amplifying impact in ways that traditional marketing can't touch. You'll learn to create content that people want to consume and that they keep coming back to you for. So some episodes of this podcast are like workshops to hone your thought leadership skills. And some include interviews of models of excellence, real-world examples of leaders who are either shifting industries, challenging norms, and building true authority, or who maybe offer specialized skills or knowledge relevant to strategic thought leadership. So if today's episode sparks something in you, if you're ready to elevate your influence and escape the old tired marketing playbook, I invite you to take the next step. Download the free Marketer's Guide to Strategic Thought Leadership, which is on the episode page, or you can get it at thought.io/guide, which is also linked in the episode description. Or you can schedule a free consultation to explore how strategic thought leadership can amplify your results. I would love the opportunity to enter your world with you and with you look forward into what strategic thought leadership can do for you. First session is on me. And you can get the link to that on the episode page, which is linked to in the episode description. In this episode, I'm joined by Jonathan Bennett, executive coach, strategic advisor, and founder of Liriday Consulting Firm. Since strategic thought leadership is about elevating influence by leading to fresh perspectives with purpose, Jonathan embodies that ideal. Jonathan brings over 25 years of experience helping purpose-driven leaders navigate complexity, align values with behavior, and build high-trust, ethical cultures. His background spans healthcare leadership, community-based initiatives, and Indigenous reconciliation work, giving him a unique lens on organizational change. In this interview, we explore the blurred lines between coaching, consulting, and advising, and how Jonathan uses storytelling and imaginative exercises to help clients gain clarity in moments of transition. He also shares insights on the shifting social contract and how younger generations are reshaping the meaning of work and leadership. So without further ado, let's jump right into the interview.
Thought Leadership Studio.
So I'm your host of Thought Leadership Studio, Chris McNeil, and I'm sitting across Zoom with Jonathan Bennett, an executive coach and strategic advisor with a remarkable track record of empowering purpose-driven leaders. As the founder of Liriday, a B Corp certified consulting firm, Jonathan has dedicated his career to helping organizations and leaders navigate complexity, align their values with their work, and foster meaningful change. With experience spanning urban, rural, remote, and First Nations communities, Jonathan brings a unique perspective to leadership and organizational development. His passion for coaching and his commitment to aligning profit with purpose have made him a trusted advisor to leaders seeking to make a lasting impact. Welcome, Jonathan.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's great to see you. And to the listener, this is the second interview because I messed up for the first time in 90-odd podcasts. I didn't press the recording button correctly. So I'm looking right now and we are actually recording. So that's great news. So great to have you back, Jonathan.
It's great. The first was just a warm-up. Now we're ready for the real thing.
We are well rehearsed. We are practiced. Absolutely. And maybe a good place to start would be going back to the conversation about the difference between a coach and an advisor and a consultant. What do you have to say on that topic? What makes someone a coach and a consultant or an advisor? And where's the wiggle room in those terms?
Yeah, I think the easy thing to say is there's a lot of overlap. The internet, though, is pretty focused. Folks on the internet are pretty focused on carving out some boundaries around each of these different professions. And, you know, I think there's some merit to it and some thought and purpose that goes into it. And it's also, in some cases, kind of arbitrary and a bit of gatekeeping. Sure. So I think it's important to kind of navigate these things with a bit of an open mind. There are aspects to, especially the coaching world, which has really matured over the course of the last sort of 10 years, especially. Lots of certification programs, lots of real focused training that goes on in order to become a coach. And but it's not a regulated profession, unlike maybe psychotherapy, let's say, or social work, which have really, you know, quite different accountabilities and quite different focuses, to say nothing of a lot of clinical research that that underpins the work there. So, you know, I think that coaching is probably growing up, and I think it's really, really relevant. I'll just speak totally personally, lest I offend coaches out there. Like, I use coaching as a tool. I sit in the pocket of conversations. I say deeply curious, and I think that my clients like it a lot. I've also found it somewhat limiting, which is to say, I bring 25 years of experience, and I've chaired lots of boards, and I've been a CEO, and I've founded a company and grown it and sold it. I have things to contribute, and I can do some of that through questioning, but I also work with people that are busy and they don't want to go on a self-discovery journey. They need consulting work and they need mentorship, or they need advice. And so I'm somebody who just looks to meet my client where they're at. I will often approach with a deeply curious stance and sit in the pocket and ask them lots of questions. But if I sense that it's not there within them, either because they haven't got enough time or they just genuinely have never come across this before, then I'll move into advice giving mode or trusted support mode, sometimes shaping out a consulting project to support them and walk alongside them with thought partnership. It really just needs to be fluid and meet my clients where they're at.
That makes perfect sense. And how many times do we run into situations as coaches or consultants where the perceived role might limit our effectiveness if we're not careful?
I guess that for me is the core question, Bruce. I think that I am unwilling to be limited, and I feel like I am skilled enough at this point in my career. If you're listening, I have a gray beard and a bald head, and so I feel like I am, called to serve and to serve whoever is in front of me at the with the best of my abilities. And as long as I have the full access and I'm, sitting in a pretty regulated spot, I feel like I'm a decent judge of the kind of support that the person needs. And I like to not be in a box. And so I don't typically call myself a coach. Other people do call me a coach, but I don't really call myself a coach. And I mostly sort of say, if I need a kind of descriptor, I'll say I'm a trusted advisor or a professional mentor, because that's mostly what I do.
Sure, it makes sense. And maybe to back up a little bit, broaden the perspective and bring the listener closer to understanding where you're coming from if they're not already familiar with your work. Was there a pivotal moment or a shift in thinking or an event that set you on a path to doing what you're doing today that you could share with the listener as a story to give them some background on why you do what you do and where you're coming from?
In a way, I've always done this work. It's just looked different along my pathway. I, for some reason, started off my career being essentially an executive assistant. I took minutes and I served CEOs and executive directors and supported them in all the things. And from there, I moved into communications roles and increasingly more complex communications roles, which sort of capped out when I was the chief communications officer of a large regional hospital here in Ontario, Canada, where I live. I served on the senior team, lots of exposures to boards. I've been on boards of directors for more than 20 years, and I'm a chartered director. And these are kind of early experiences for me, allowed me, long before I had anything much to contribute, but to be in proximity of a lot of decision making and a lot of power and authority. And I think I just absorbed it. Good, the good and the bad. And I've spent a lifetime sorting out the good from the bad and what I want to pass on and which nuggets are still worth it and which ones have were never good and some have aged out, which I think is kind of an interesting topic. So I suppose I don't know if it was one particular point. I could certainly point to a few key transformational moments in my career. I landed a role at this big hospital and I felt like I was just a fish out of water. I'd never worked in acute care before. And here was this 24/7, you know, institution with 3,000 employees and four trade unions and very complex set of circumstances. We were building a new hospital, and we were the subject of much media inquiry because of this huge capital project and a massive fundraising campaign. You know, and I don't want to get into healthcare because I'm in Canada and that'll just trigger a whole bunch of people if you've got American listeners. But I'm grateful because it was kind of like three free MBAs. You know, I just would go into the office, into the hospital at 6 in the morning before rounds to meet with physicians. And sometimes I wouldn't leave until 11 at night after I'd, you know, shepherded the last of the audit and finance committee members out the door. And it was a very unsustainable job. They're particularly unhealthy places to work. And it's a shame because, of course, they ought to be among the most sophisticated and the most focused on care. But they tend to run themselves just like everybody was the emergency department and that everything was urgent. And everybody's hair's on fire. And it really, of course, shouldn't be like that. And the best hospitals are not. But I think it's more than common for the environments in acute care to be like that. And so I learned just an awful lot about leadership, about, I had an outsized amount of influence, but not a direct like line in a P&L. Like I just didn't have a lot of employees, but I was in charge of lots of things at various times. I had patient relations and I had risk management for a while, government relations, marketing, branding. Like it was a big portfolio that kind of ebbed and flowed as the needs of the organization ebbed and flowed. And when I finally chose to leave, it had been about, I think 6.5 years, I was so done. I was absolutely exhausted, but I think ultimately very grateful for the exposure to that extremely frenetic, complicated world.
How does that advise how you look at organizations now?
I think about my time there and my proximity to complexity a lot, because just about everything I deal with is not that hard, not as hard as that world. I don't want to say never, because I deal with some clients that have some pretty some pretty awesome problems, for sure. But in terms of just moving parts and a workforce that is highly regulated, highly complex with lots of moving parts and everybody's looking at it. I learned an awful lot. And I think, you know, if anybody's listening to this and they're in healthcare, they'll understand it. It does risk itself getting a bit high on itself, right? Like healthcare thinks it's just, you know, the beginning and an end of it, all of it. And there is life after healthcare. And there's a lot more, for me, there's been far more work that's been meaningful that has happened in a slower, more considered, iterative, thoughtful way. And I'm really drawn to that kind of work now. I don't enjoy fast-paced, high-stress environments the way I did when I was young, but largely because I think the results aren't sustainable. And they're just addicted to change in healthcare. And I'm doing community-based work that is very inclusive and very evolutionary. And I think that the results that I'm seeing and the kind of transformations that I'm seeing is far more impressive, and I get a lot more personal satisfaction out of it.
Well, let's talk more about the community-based work, the kind of work that attracts you. What attracts you about it, and how do you find the levers for change in those situations?
Well, I think often it's a personal journey when you get involved at a community level. I'm the co-chair of a community health center. So this is a grassroots organization that serves vulnerable people in our community. We employ primary healthcare practitioners like physicians and nurse practitioners, mm-hmm. and nurses and dietitians. But the organization has a shared governance model between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And I was the founding co-chair of this organization. We're still pretty new. And so we're on this shared governance journey to understand how do we steward and take care of an organization that's serving vulnerable people in the community, many of whom are Indigenous, in a way that is accessible, is culturally relevant and appropriate, is welcoming. And that to me has been very deep personal work, because you can't sit around a board table and just look to Robert's rules
sure.
and, you know, managing time. My colleagues that are Indigenous have so much wisdom and a completely different way of looking at life. And for me, it's been a kind of interrogation of how I do governance work. I mean, I sit on two corporate boards, and I've been on boards my whole life, and I'm trained, and I do board training all the time. But here I am with Indigenous folks that don't want to do that. It feels colonial, and the decision-making isn't how they do decision-making in their communities. And so they want the boardroom to reflect their work in a good way. And so I have learned a lot about what that means. And it's really re-engineering how I'm approaching governance, because I'm using skills and tools that I'm learning at that nonprofit board in my for-profit board work, in how I chair, in how I hold space, and in how I conduct meetings is just really changing quite appreciably. So there's a great ripple effect, and I'm learning lots.
Interesting collision of views of the world. And so has the empathy that of working with that kind of setting shift your worldview in general and the other engagements that you have?
I've been doing work in and around Indigenous reconciliation in Canada for quite a long time, mm-hmm. and I have a personal connection to it as well. And so so it's important work for me, but it's work that's kind of never done. It's a kind of an ongoing investigation of, you know, for sure, like your privilege and the way you show up in spaces, but also to just understand more about an Indigenous worldview, and that while you're never going to appropriate it or use it in a kind of, I don't know, like a way that you're not supposed to or allowed to, or that's, you know, just going to be harmful. I think there's just great teachings there about different ways of doing work that can get different things done. I'll give you an example if you want.
Yeah.
Like I'm on Treaty 20, which is Williams Treaty here in Ontario. And I, you know, I'm just blessed to be brought into circles with Indigenous people who, when they start their work and they start a meeting, the kind of the loose translation of what they're doing is they're visiting. And, you know, like you and I wouldn't go into a business meeting and sit there for 45 minutes and say, you know, if I was meeting you, I wouldn't ask you where your grandparents are from.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say, oh, and then what happened? Like, where, you know, and then how are all your kids? And, oh, that sounds hard that your mom's not doing well. And tell me more about that. But that is how they start their meetings. It's very relational work. And it looks like they're wasting time. That's what it looks like is happening. But what I've learned is, in fact, the opposite is happening. What they're doing is they're kind of going slow to go fast.
Mm-hmm.
They spend a lot of time building trust, deeply seeing the humanity in the person sitting across from them and learning where they're at and what their needs are. And then when the meeting starts, the politics, the passive aggressive remarks, the using power and tools that we have around, let's say, a board table, that kind of game playing tends to not go on. Like, I'm not saying they're perfect, but like they've breached such a level of reached such a level of trust that they don't have to they don't have to do that to get consensus to find the right way forward. And so it's just a different way of doing things. So how do I do things differently? So now I'm in a corporate board setting. And instead of just saying, great, can I have approval for the minutes? Are there any conflicts of interest? Like, let's dive in. I'll say, let's go around and do a check-in round.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? How are you showing up today? What's going on in your world? Just take a couple minutes. And so I'll take 15 minutes. People are 20 minutes. People are used to it now. Like, I don't take an hour. And sure. My colleagues around the CHC kind of do. But you know, I'll take as much time as socially kind of awkwardness will allow me to take. But I'm facilitating it. And I'm already noticing good results. I'm already noticing a change in the quality of the conversation. The depth of relationship is improving. And so I think that these are good things.
That's a powerful look outside the conventional filters of our Western industrial view. And I think it was John Grinder who said the best way to understand your own mind is to visit another culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Start to question some of these norms, some of these belief systems. And I love the going slow to go fast. I can see how that aligns with the values alignment type of work that we've discussed. How do values guide your work with your clients? How do you understand prevalent values and help organizations get aligned around values consciously?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring this up. I've been thinking a lot about it. I've done values, you know, work helping organizations to articulate their values. I would say from a lens that looks something approximate to branding work. Like, that's kind of how I've approached it historically, is through kind of open-ended questions and focus groups and other tools to kind of like harvest what feels like an organization's set of words, and then the definitions that support their words. And I can usually get them to, you know, land on a half dozen words that are really accurately describe what it's like to be here and what our culture will tolerate and where the lines of acceptability here, like kind of like what's our ethical model.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always felt that that work is good work. And I'm starting to see, though, that, you know, you're always at risk of articulating pretty things on pieces of paper that go on a boardroom wall and are not really represented well in the culture of the organization. And this is always the risk, is that it looks great, but it doesn't actually live in the DNA. And the thing that I've been thinking about a lot more, Chris, is the connection with values and behavior.
Yes.
And so that's when values get tested. So these days, when I'm doing work around values for an organization, I'm asking far more for stories around behavioral responses inside the organization. What are we willing to tolerate? What are we willing to look away from? What do we insist on? These are the kinds of lines of questions now that tend to get me, I think, less six pretty words on the boardroom wall and more an ongoing conversation that really pushes an organization to think about how it's showing up for one another, for itself, for the people in its orbit, suppliers, you know, in the nonprofit sector, donors and funders and clients, and, you know, in the for-profit sector, it might be your whatever supply chain, your clients, your customers, you name it. So I think about these things quite a bit now, and I think I'm changing my mind on how to best work around purpose-driven work. And I'm shifting more and more towards behavior now as a thing to both note, articulate, name, and then change if it's not what we like.
Well, there's the values that we write on the wall, and there's those that we live by. And people are our greatest asset, gets tested when sales are down. And do you lay off people?
Yeah.
Find another way.
Yeah.
How do we deal with the situations where an organization's kind of taken on a life of its own? It's grown beyond the infancy stage, and we have a board to report to, who's looking for strong quarterly profits, and yet we want to be purpose-driven and value-driven. How do we navigate those situations? How do we get more congruence and walk our talk better?
I think when we say the quiet part out loud, that's when cultures do better. Like high trust environments are typically environments that have deep accountability. They're safe environments. And when we say, when we have leaders that include people in the decision making, that have a level of transparency that is outsized for what folks are used to, they'll double down on their commitment to the organization, and they'll withstand a poor quarter, or worst case scenario, or second worst case scenario, a series of layoffs, because it ultimately is a bigger thing than the organization itself. Like, it's about people's identity. Mm-hmm. And especially young folks, they just want to have a, your word there is congruent. Like they want to be congruent with who they are, and they want their work, their place in the work world of work to match. And that, it is a change. It's not like we didn't care, and we meaning, I'm the Gen Xer. Like it's not like I didn't care about things. I worked in nonprofits and I've worked in healthcare. I mean, I've been pretty, quote unquote, mission driven my whole life. I've got a long connection with the arts, and all of those things really matter to me. But I think what's changed is just the economic reality for young people. Like, the promise of a route to middle class safety and security has just been broken, and it's very hard to say to somebody in their 20s, you should work late, you should put it in because it's in your best interest, when they look at you and say, I'm never going to own a house, I can barely afford my groceries, and like a living wage is not enough. And that's very difficult. Like, it's almost like the social contract has been broken. And how I think we see it play out is in the workplace. It's in workplace culture, and they are articulate, and they know what's going on. They might not know, they haven't been in the world of work a long time, so there's lots of things they don't know for sure. And I have a lot of sympathy with my clients, many of whom are CEOs and who have workforces who they're struggling to understand what the motivation is. And, my read on it is that the gap between, what it's like to be in a position of leadership and what it's like to be entering the journey is bigger than ever. And the promises have changed, and the pathways have changed. And that's the disconnect, I think, that people don't see it. People reflect back, when you're at the top, you reflect back on what it was like for you.
Mm-hmm.
And those things aren't true anymore. The conditions have changed. A lot's happened in 25 years. And I think it's really, I have a lot of sympathy for young people that are thinking about, how to build a career, where to go, how to go about doing it. And, I think we're seeing some, in some cases, exacerbation, in some cases, like, screw it, I'll just be an entrepreneur. Like a kind of, like recklessness because there is no security, which, great things come of that kind of
guilty as charged.
yeah. Me too. Right. Me too. But I think it's something when you're building it on the back of, or a career already well in progress.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing when you're 20 something and you don't even know really who you are or what you like, but you're still willing to take a bet on yourself and start a business and grow something. That to me is just really exciting, but it's coming from a place not always of entrepreneurship and ultimate risk taking. It's coming from a place of like, what else can I do? Like, what other choices have I got? And,
right.
I don't love that part of it, but the outcome part of it, I think that ultimately they'll be mostly great.
One of the things that drove my journey into entrepreneurship starting at age 23, 24 was a big anti-authoritarian bent. that came in part from seeing corruption in leadership. And I had a manager who doctored contracts. I quit the job when I found out and moved on, went to his leadership. They kept him on because he was hitting numbers. And it's like, this is not how a business should be run. But then I've seen examples of principle-centered leadership as well, that's coming from a place of contribution and giving. How do we sort those out? And what would you recommend to the younger listener of this who's and maybe at a crossroads of decision and evaluating a path into an organization or following their own lead into an industry? How do you know what's right for you?
That is a great question, and it's a complex one, I think. I mean, first and foremost, your ethical model is something that is for you and for you only to understand. And often it doesn't become clear until something is clanging against it. Something in the pit of your stomach just says, this isn't right. Like when that guy was doctoring a contract, you knew that that was breaking the law. It's fraudulent. And things like that happen in small ways and big ways in the world of work, sadly, all the time. And sometimes it's not legal. Sometimes it's a kind of relational acts of bad faith, people screwing each other over, or people just behaving intolerably bad and yet getting away with it. I have a client right now that is dealing with a toxic boss, and the human resources around it is just absolutely appalling. How poor they're, not investigating, not following through, not what I would describe as doing the basics well. And this happens all the time to people. And so, when those folks are in my, when I'm working with them, when they're in my practice, I usually sort of like to think about it as like, because there's practical overlays here. Like people have a mortgage or they've got rent to pay or, the kids at the school. I can't quit, Jonathan. Like I'd like to just quit, but I can't. And like, so the metaphor that I like to use as this isn't a fork in the road, but there's a fork in the road that is coming. And so knowing that gives a bit of grace and a bit of air. Like, you're not stuck forever, but you're stuck for now. And what things can we do to help you make a choice when and if the time comes? Because there's only so long. Like, do we agree that the conditions for success are not present? And if the answer is yes, they're never going to change. They're a narcissist, or they're horrible, or they're doing things that I'm not sure are legal, or I'm just bored out of my brains and they treat me badly. Like, whatever the case, whatever your individual case may be. It's like the point might be not we're at the fork in the road today. It like the folks rarely come to me when it's like today. Like, do I quit or do I stay today? I mean, it does happen, but like that's not usually it. It's usually like I'm noticing that I'm not doing well and I can't just quit and I don't know what to do. And so I sort of say, up ahead is a fork in the road. And it's gonna come. And either at some point you're gonna quit in a huff and then you won't be able to pay your next month's rent. Maybe you're gonna get fired because you'll say one too many salty things. Or you can chart a new path and build something new for yourself. Maybe you're gonna go out on your own, maybe you're gonna look for a new job, maybe it is finally time to retire. Maybe you're going to buy a business. Like, who knows what's going on for that person? But how do we move that thing from maybe sure I should, probably, yeah, I'll eventually get to it, to let's create a project out of it and get at it? Because if we let that fork in the road come to us, then life is going to insist that we head down one of the other pathways, and maybe it's not the one that's going to serve us best. So we often do have a little more control than we think we do. It feels like things are helpless, but they ought not to. And I like to work with people on moving those fuzzy kind of amorphous type ideas of what maybe they should be doing next and structuring it so there's a plan of attack, and we're going to create a project out of this, and we're going to make this thing happen because it is the thing that's deep down, you know, where we want to be or where we want to go, or at least the next thing that feels like a good choice.
That's powerful. And a number of things come to mind, Jonathan. One of them is I like the zooming out and looking at a broader time frame, a longer time horizon.
Yeah.
And it probably gets people out of distress a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
To be able to take that view. And another is the helping someone take this amorphous, I want something different, but I'm not sure what, and get more clarity.
Yeah.
For the benefit of the listener, what kind of questions do you ask, or how do you guide people to get that greater clarity on what we actually really want?
Oh, yeah, sure. So sometimes I'll say things like, okay, imagine it's 3 years from now and it's a Tuesday afternoon. What are you doing? Like, how are you spending your time? What's in your calendar?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I get to kind of ask them to really get concrete and orientate themselves imaginatively in the future. And sometimes, you know, I'll just like, somebody will say, well, I'm doing this. And then I go to this meeting and I'm meeting with this person. And then from there, I can just ping questions. Like, I'm like, are you selling something? Are you buying something? Are you running the meeting? Are you participating in the meeting? Are you, tell me about the building. Do you own it? Like, I can be quite sort of almost like silly and provocative, you know?
Sure.
And sometimes I get really quite strong reactions from people, which is just, my wife is a psychotherapist, and she'll often say to me, that's interesting information.
All right.
Which is that very non-judgmental thing that therapists say, right?
Sure.
But it's a great line because I'm often presented with interesting information, and that comes in the form of non-reactions, strong reactions, you know, people that are equivocating. Like it's all good. And so, you know, that's for sure a question that I like to say. Sometimes I'll go backwards in time and like, tell me about a time when you were at your best at work. What were you doing? Who you were working with? What was lighting you up? And sometimes there's secrets and clues in there. Where this is often building towards, though, is that if somebody is at a true kind of career fork in the road, I'm not a career coach or something. That's not at all what I do. But one thing that I do that I think pretty much comes from me from way back being a novelist, I've written a bunch of fiction. And so is I just sort of use a kind of character rap sheet to provoke people into choice making around their career. So what that'll look like is like, if you came to me and you said, I just can't figure out what I want to do next. I'll understand what your skills and experiences are and all that kind of stuff. And then I create 5 to 7 scenarios of somewhat plausible, but at a stretch jobs for you. And I write them out. And I come in and I say, I'm going to read you a scenario as if you're doing this job. So you have to pretend that for some reason, life is weird and you've just been asked to do this job and now you're in the job. And then I tell them what the job is, how much it pays, like what their responsibilities, what their span of control is, what their influence is, the sector, who reports to it. And the reactions that folks give me are all over the place. Like sometimes, you know, they recoil. They're like, oh my God, I would hate this. This would be awful. It's like my idea of like a worst job ever. And I'm like, tell me more.
Yeah.
What that's do you awesome. Hate about that? Because that's great information, right? It's helping us to just, you know, every time we find out something that they dislike a lot and why, it helps us narrow in on what would be good. And sometimes I'll drop somebody in a job that they've never thought of before or never heard of before, because I've seen some sort of you know, transferable skills or experiences that they have never really thought about before. And they get really curious about it. They're like, what, why is this interesting? I'm like, I don't know. Let's talk about it. You know? And then we kind of like play imaginatively. And I have taken that exercise. It takes a couple of sessions to kind of go through it, but I've taken people from completely stuck with no ideas to going on full scale job searches with networking and everything to, you know, move where they're at in their career to some new thing. All the way to, you know, going back to school, starting businesses. In one case, somebody like leaving her current role, becoming a consultant and a conceptual artist at the same time. And like, so like really quite fun and powerful things come from doing that kind of work. And I do really enjoy it. It's really quite, it takes a lot from me, actually. I have to give a lot of myself. It's not, you know, I'm not just phoning it in when I'm doing that work. Like I really have to concentrate.
That's a fascinating approach. I mean, so what I'm understanding to regurgitate, make sure I'm following you, is you're applying the character and story archetypes of the fiction writer to maybe unlock people from self-imposed limitations a bit.
Yep. You got it.
That's an art form in itself.
Maybe. I never really thought about it. I just sort of like, I'm sure other people do things like this. I just like, for me, it just sort of happened organically one day. I just like, I think you need to be put in multiple future versions of yourself. And it's almost like going clothes shopping and just trying things on. And it's not until you look at yourself in the mirror and say, how does this make me feel, that you can kind of know. I think it's a sort of similar experience. It's quite visceral, actually. You know, if I do it well, I've lit people's imagination up.
Well, and you're interrupted a pattern. I mean, we tend to repeat the past if we're not careful.
It's true.
And I imagine that's a big part of what you help leaders do in general, is to be more conscious of that.
Yeah. I mean, being like self-awareness work and being more conscious of how you're showing up and how people are perceiving you is a huge part of what I consider to be leadership work and often why people come to me is, you know, I don't know, I just want to get better at doing this. Like there's a piece of that is for sure. It's real, Chris. Yeah.
Fascinating. So Jonathan, we usually wind these interviews up with two kinds of questions. And you might recall, the first one is from your background, knowing the type of person who listens to this podcast, founders, entrepreneurs, marketers, thought leaders, people who want to make a difference in communication, with communication. What would be the top three things you would recommend they do to get better at that? First question. Second question, if someone's listening to this and thinking, I think Jonathan would make a great mentor for our C-suite people or myself, or like to reach out to him, how would someone reach out to you?
Yeah, for sure. So the first question was top three recommendations. I think doing self-work is really important. So for some people that's mindfulness, for others it's journaling, for others it's reading, but just doing it in a deliberate and conscious way, that to me feels really important. The second is look for opportunities to get yourself into discomfort. And for me, that can mean a young person that, you know, long before they're ready, goes and volunteers and sits on a community board, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They'd think, well, who would have me? Well, it's a volunteer position. You'd be surprised.
Yes.
They're all looking for young people. And what you get out of it is exposure to decision making. A group of colleagues that are maybe 20 years older than you or more, maybe they're retired, and they'll like nothing more than spending time and teaching you how you know, what they know about leadership. And it'll make for a great series of stories in your next job interview. Instead of just what you've done during the day, you can say, yes, and you know, I've been on this board for a few years, and here's what I've done, and here's the issues. You've got a whole another set of experiences that are leadership based to draw on. And I just think that I just feel really strongly that's a really underused, you know, element of expansiveness when it comes to people's leadership. And I guess the third would be just improving your listening skills.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime that you can observe how you listen, how you're holding space for somebody, you know, you've done it beautifully here, Chris, is demonstrated, you've mirrored back, you've checked whether or not you're tracking a few times. Like these are learned skills at some point along the way, you figured out, or you took a course, or you had a mentor and somebody taught you or you observed how to do these things. And they're not inherent things that, somehow we're born with. People get good at them through practice and through observation. And you can read books and you can take training on how to just be a deeper listener. And most of us sit around not listening, just waiting for our turn to talk and polishing up this thing that we're going to say next. And while we're doing that, we're not listening to one another. And great leaders are people that can really listen. So they're my three. How can people get to me? So a couple of ways. I'm really active on LinkedIn. So please look me up on LinkedIn and shoot me a DM. I always offer a trial session to anybody that wants to consider working with me. And what's new is that I have a private podcast that I'm just at the moment releasing, which is a chance for folks to listen to six sessions I've had with real clients and me do my work. And they're really, really different clients.
Oh, nice.
But if you're thinking about, like, I don't know, like, how would that be? How would his work really be? You can listen to some episodes of the podcast and have an eavesdrop in on a real session, and you'll know exactly how I work and the kinds of things that I support people with. So there's a couple pieces there.
Great. And to the listener, I'm going to link to these on the episode page. So if you're listening on the app, the link to that's in the episode description. It's been a pleasure, Jonathan.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you as well.
Thought Leadership Studio.
Thanks again for listening to Thought Leadership Studio. I'm your host, Chris McNeil, strategic thought leadership coach, consultant, and trainer, creator of the thought process of strategic thought leadership, and author of the upcoming book, Strategic Thought Leadership. And this has been episode 96, Leading with Integrity and Imagination with Jonathan Bennett, where we explored the power of values-driven leadership, the importance of behavioral alignment in organizational culture, and how imaginative approaches like storytelling can guide people through ethical crossroads and career clarity. We also cover topics like the shifting social contract in today's workforce, the difference between coaching, consulting, and advising, and how to recognize when it's time to make a thoughtful pivot towards something more aligned. If you'd like to go even deeper into today's conversation and you're listening on an app, head over to the episode page at thoughtleadershipstudio.com, which is linked in the episode description. There you'll find a curated transcript, links to Jonathan's site and resources mentioned, and actionable insights from our dialogue. While you're there, explore additional tools to elevate your influence and impact, like the free download, The Marketer's Guide to Strategic Thought Leadership, which is also linked in the podcast description, or schedule a free consultation with me to discover how strategic thought leadership can help you lead with more clarity, purpose, and effectiveness in all the marketing, communication, and leadership you do. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to share it with someone who would benefit from Jonathan's insights, or post it on your socials to help us expand this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. It helps us create more of this kind of meaningful content for you. Until next time, I'm Chris McNeil, and this is Thought Leadership Studio.
Thought Leadership Studio.